Welcome to the Full Accuracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 4:05 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is May 13th and it's being Friday, but it's the Friday the 13th, and it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with the Baltic Dry Index. And one thing that I think stands out clearly is that it has been up for 5 consecutive weeks, and the stock market has been down for 5 consecutive weeks, although it did start to rebound over the last 2 days. So something's obviously different here compared to what's happening in the stock market. So I think we're potentially at least being presented with a bifurcation, and or at least a representation of what stagflation looks like. The Baltic Dry Index is representative of the price of ships that move big dry goods around, like iron ore and coal and ships full of wheat when it's available. And it's big bulk commodities more often than not. And in an inflationary environment, there's a big incentive to try and source as many commodities as you can, get them to places where you can sell them for a premium, and it creates demand for shipping. So that makes sense, at least that it might be reasonable to anticipate that rates might be rising for ships. And because we're in an inflationary environment, and because commodities are generally a bit more expensive than they have been, the supply of ships isn't about to increase anytime soon either. When we look at reports from Samsung Heavy or Hyundai Heavy, who are some of the big ship constructors in South Korea, they don't anticipate a big increase in supply until well into 2024. So there isn't going to be a big response in terms of the supply of ships right now. And then, of course, there's an additional ripple, or I guess wrinkle in the argument, and it's that there are going to be new environmental regulations that are going to start to be imposed from July and will go into full effect in tw early 2023. And it's all about emissions from ships. The global ambition is to bring down ship emissions by 50% by 2030, and that's a rather swift pace. So, what it's going to, in fact, represent is slow steaming. There's a logarithmic relationship between the speed or the revs in the engine and emissions. So, by slow steaming, they are going to emit fewer emissions, and on aggregate, most ships are going to go 10% slower. So if they go 10% slower, it means you need 10% more ships to do the same amount of work. And that's a cost. So it's likely that we're going to see upward pressure on bulk commodities. Then we can think about the Dirty Tanker Index, which is really all about the oil tanker business. And one thing that I find interesting is this is really an exceptionally volatile index. It tends to whip around a lot with no real discernible trends, but we can definitely see that when it goes up a lot, it comes straight back down a lot. And then, of course, there are the kinds of ships that don't carry bulk commodities but focus more on containers. And the container price went through the roof in 2020 and 2021, but it is starting to come back down. Well, the kind of things that go into containers would be consumer electronics, pieces of furniture, anything you can buy in IKEA or Tesco or Costco or Walmart. So all of those travel in on containers, but they primarily focus on consumer demand. So as inflationary pressures rise, consumers, they also respond to rising prices by decreasing what they buy. So One thing that I think is particularly interesting right now is that the negative quarter of growth in the USA was discounted by the media as a technical deterioration, not really an economic deterioration. And they pointed to the strength of the consumer. But the consumer is, in fact, buying fewer goods. It's simply that the price of those goods has risen so much that the average spend is pretty similar, but the number of goods they're buying is, in fact, decreasing. So the container price is starting to come back down. And it did get up to an awfully big psychological level around the psychological 10,000. So, and it's also an historically exceptionally high level. And without a buoyant consumer, then there's no reason for it to be this high. So, with the Baltic Dry Index going up and the container index going down, well, then what that is really starting to suggest is that we're in a stagflationary environment. And this is obviously a difficult thing to deal with, since we're really at a point now in the cycle where nobody who's under the age of about 60 has ever had to deal with a stagflationary environment. Now, if we think about commodities, still the most important of them all is oil. And oil is also being influenced by this new suite of regulations in the shipping industry. The price was up another $4 in here today. This has been a very orderly consolidation. There's a sequence of higher reaction lows, and we're now right in the region of the sequence of lower rally highs. And because of these new regulations in shipping, well, it's creating additional demand for diesel, and diesel's a middle distillate, and so is jet fuel. So if we look at diesel prices, well, anyone who's driving a truck or a diesel car will certainly be noticing now that diesel prices are ramping higher, at least for retailers. So this is a direct response to both the higher price of oil, but then the fact that we have a massive new source of demand, that all those ships that had once relied on bunker fuel are now way up the crack spread in terms of where their demand has migrated. So this is putting upward pressure on various parts of the crack spread. And of course, this is also then creating profit opportunities for some of the refiners, and obviously then also the energy companies themselves. There's been an acute lack of investment in the energy sector because you had massive endowments getting rid of their energy investments. Nobody wanted to be seen to be investing in it. And there was a huge concentration on the ESG merits of investing. One thing that I think is interesting is that if we look at the ESG aware MSCI ETF, well, I think it's particularly in easy to highlight that it looks almost identical to the Nasdaq 100. And then when we look at its constituents, well, what you really have is just a FANG index. And it's very easy to say that the majority of technology companies are ESG friendly because they're technology companies. They don't have to go out and metal bash. They employ other people to do that on their behalf. And they don't take any of the blame for example, people throwing themselves out of windows at Apple's manufacturing facilities in China. Well, they don't show up on Apple's ESG. That'd be Foxconn. And of course, Foxconn's not on this list. So the ESG way of defining companies is exceptionally subjective. And of course, what we're really being presented with is just a technology overlay. And I think this has been abundantly clear for investors over the course of the last couple of weeks in particular, because the NASDAQ is an exceptionally well-owned index. A lot of people buy it through ETFs, but a lot of people own it. They don't even know they own it. And it came all the way back down this week to test the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, when I started shorting, I first was a little early. Then I happened to catch good timing, and I'm still short, but I am now, I've got everything protected by stops. The secular trend mean is the 1,000-day moving average. So it's 5 years of trading. And it doesn't get tested all that often. Now, we can see that from approximately 2010 onwards, the market has come back into this area a couple of times, but it has never broken below. So by that metric, we're now at a buying opportunity level. And the one other very clear unifying characteristic behind the bounces from the region of the 1,000-day moving average have been that they've coincided with the end of periods of quantitative tightening or the end of a period where there hasn't been liquidity provision. So if we then just think about the 2015-16, the end of 2018 and early 2020, or I guess the 2019 period, and then look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet. So in 2015 and 16, we were at the end of one of those quantitative easing program times. And then from 2017 onwards, well, then we had the Trump tax cuts, which really ignited interest. Then at the end of 2018, well, quantitative tightening didn't end until 2019, but the Federal Reserve stopped raising interest rates, and it was pretty clear from that point onwards that they were going to support the market. Then, of course, we had the massive assistance program in 2020, which carried through into 2021, and now that's over. So we're really only at the beginning of a new interest rate hiking cycle now, and the stock market has already fully priced it in and is now starting to attempt to rebound. But it's on the assumption that there's an end in sight to the interest rate hiking cycle. But what is the Fed, in fact, going to do? Now, one thing that I thought was interesting this week is that Jerome Powell came out and he said that he thinks that the neutral rate is about 2.5%. And maybe it's 3%. But the thing is that it's exceptionally difficult to say with confidence what the neutral rate is. And the neutral rate is generally defined as the point in the interest rate cycle where it's neither supportive or contractionary. And if we're really thinking that that's 2.5%, well, that's about as high as interest rates got in the hiking period that ended at the end of 2018. And the quantity of debt has increased substantially since then. It went up by 25% alone in 2020. So, considering that every interest rate hike increases the cost of servicing the debt, then one would have to think that perhaps the neutral rate is a bit lower than 2.5%. Maybe it's only 1.5%. Maybe it is 2%. Maybe we're there already. And perhaps that's why the stock market has been pulling back. So the Fed obviously wants to have an environment where they can get a soft landing. And that's easier said than done. So as we think about what's going to happen next, well, The Federal Reserve has basically confirmed that they're going to raise rates by 50 basis points in June, and they're going to do it again in July and take us up to 2%. And after that, they might slow down once they get to the what they think is the neutral rate. They might just start to slow down their interest rate hikes. So I think it's interesting that we are getting a rebound, and Bitcoin got all the way down to test its 1,000-day moving average yesterday, and then it rebounded. And now we're testing the 30,000 level. Now, the 30,000 level was the low back in early 2021. And now it's potentially offering some resistance. Now, the one thing we can certainly say is that the 1,000-day moving average has been really reliable as a lead indicator for the buying opportunities in Bitcoin over the course of the last decade. And if it were to sustain a move below it and much less encounter resistance in the region of that 1,000-day moving average, well, then we'd have to conclude that the uptrend is over. Now, I did mention in the audio and in commentary that I feel like I've been bombarded by people talking about the promise of technology. And I really felt like I was a lonely person talking about the promise of technology a decade ago. And now everybody's talking about it. And it's not no longer enough to talk about Moore's Law. Now, of course, Moore's Law was directly applied to the semiconductors business. And what it predicted was that the number of the transistors on a chip would double every 18 months, and it was incredibly predictive. Now, the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is coming back rather heavily. One of the challenges for the sector is that it is highly cyclical, and nothing has happened to change the cyclicality. So, what happens when prices rise is in order to secure supply, because there's just a shortage of these things, then what companies do is they buy more. They put in double orders to ensure that they're the ones that get their orders filled, or if they order twice as much, they might get half their order filled. So then they feel like they have to continue to order more. And obviously, this is a challenging environment because eventually the consumers have as much inventory as they want, and then the price of the commodity just goes through the floor. So we've had a meaningful trend deterioration, and it's come back down towards the 1,000-day moving average, hasn't really got there yet. Then, because we're in a period of technological innovation, Moore's Law has been, in many respects, forgotten about because we've had now got lots of examples of exponential growth. And that's most particularly true in quantum computing. So the iterations that we're getting in quantum computing are really, truly spectacular. And they're going up twice as fast. And innovation is happening twice as fast as it used to do in the semiconductor sector. And the number of gene editing operations that can be completed is also, and the cost of those is falling at an exponential rate as well. So this is much faster than anything that we ever saw with Moore's Law. And then on top of that, you have Metcalfe's Law. Metcalfe's Law is all about networking and the power of the network. So we've had lots of examples of valuable networks being set up over the course of the last 20 years. Obviously, the internet is a big one, and it grew like a weed. So This is obviously one of the first examples. Now, what they're also then pointing to is the inevitability of Bitcoin rising to extraordinary additional levels because of the network effect. And the more people that are using it, the more likely it is that more people will use it. But there is a difference. And it's that mold growth can be exponential. And it can also benefit from Moore's law. And it can also then be destroyed quickly by sunlight or by hydrogen peroxide. But and if you cut off the fuel, well, then it dies. And unfortunately, as we move into a tighter financial condition environment, then some of these really extraordinary bullish phenomena, they start to break down. And it is quite normal to see really enthusiastic forward projections for future potential occurring at tops. And people still want to buy the dip. And because it has worked every single time in the last decade, there are millions of people who've been conditioned to believe that it will work indefinitely. So we're in an interesting environment because the trends are no longer consistent. And as we come down towards this 1,000-day moving average, it's absolutely normal to see buy the dip starting to come back to evidence. But until we start to see bond yields coming back down, and then we'll have some support for it. Now, yesterday, the 10-year yield was on a downside weekly Q reversal, but then it rallied in here today. So it did not close below the low of the previous week. Now it did dip down into the underlying range, so perhaps we're going to see some additional pause and consolidation in this area. But there is certainly the potential that we're going to have upward pressure on yields. Because if this is a stagflationary environment where oil prices continue to rise and inflationary pressures remain acute, then that's going to continue to put upward pressure on central banks to act. And they have not yet expressed any disquiet at the size of the pullback we've had on Wall Street. So I would anticipate that there will be a short covering rally. There will be some pause and consolidation. We might even see ranges forming between the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving average. But we're unlikely to see a really substantial rebound and re-extension of this bull market until we start to see interest rates coming back down. Now, gold prices have been quite weak and pulled back again in here today to test the $1,800 level. And this has been a meaningful pullback. We've had a $200, a 10% decline in the space of less than a month. So we have a short-term oversold condition, and we're in the region of the upper side of the underlying trading range. So we need an upward dynamic to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. If we have a stagflationary environment where central banks are inhibited from raising rates aggressively and we have slowing growth as well, well, it suggests then that there will be price controls. So oil prices remain very firm, and Spain was one of the first countries in here this week to introduce price controls on oil. So this is obviously something that's rather important. And I think it is likely that we're going to start to see price controls coming in as a way of mitigating some of the inflationary pressures. And one important factor is that price controls work. but only for a short period of time. When they're eventually removed, as we've seen from the 1970s, then it also pulls back, or when once they're removed, inflation, having pulled back during that period, explodes higher. I suspect that we're going to see more of these kinds of policies, because if politicians can't do anything about a market-based price, well, then the easy solution is to ensure that it is not a market-based price. Now, wheat is right back in the region of its highs. It was in mildly negative territory today, but still really very firm overall. We also started to see that with oil firming, some of the oil-related contracts have also perked up. So sugar prices were up in a reasonably dynamic manner and bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average and remain in really quite a consistent uptrend overall. And coffee prices, having rebounded earlier on this week from the region of the 200-day moving average, are continuing to pause around this area. It's quite clear now that we've got a lot of commodities that are very close to all-time peaks or approaching those peaks and pausing, but not pulling back in a really violent manner. Now, copper prices pulled back sharply last week and extended the decline in here this week, and increasingly it looks like an evolving type 2 top formation with failed upside breaks, a lengthier range, and a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. But even in a type 2 top formation environment, then we can often get a period of ranging. And it wouldn't be all that surprising to see a multi-month period of ranging between 400 and 450 before lower levels are eventually tested. Because this is more emblematic of global growth, and global growth is slowing down. Now, what's happening in China, I think, hasn't been fully discounted by investors just yet. There are certainly two news stories this week that are worth considering in the short term. Well, the first one here is that the CSI 300 is starting to steady, and it's still right in the region of its lows, and there's the potential, at least, that the government is going to try and support the market. But two things that are happening. The first is that Li Keqiang, who really hasn't been making a lot of public statements for a few years and is due to retire in less than 3 months, well, he's starting to make more public statements about the need for economic growth and stability. And then the counterbalancing argument here that Xi Jinping is very much in power and he's doing whatever he can to ensure that that power is unquestioned. Well, there are rumors and anecdotal evidence, at least, that when people try to exit the country, they're having their green cards and their foreign residency cards caught up by exports of the border officials, which obviously is a really troubling environment. Sorry about that, I had to close my door. Well, what that means is China's shutting down. They don't want their people leaving because they don't want them coming back and bringing the coronavirus back in with them. But what people have been fearing is that China would move into more of a Maoist society and that they were moving more towards a North Korea type environment because China's been cut off from the rest of the world for most of the last 2 years. And the political imperative is to ensure that Xi Jinping can become ruler for life. So this is obviously weighing on the market. And then we have the additional point that the property sector is under severe stress. And Sunac Property Developers, the fourth largest and by some measures the third largest, defaulted on their offshore debt in here this week. So the renminbi remains quite weak. Now, arguably, the renminbi is catching up with the yen. So what we're seeing in Asia is competitive currency devaluation, and the yen pulled back all the way through March and April, and then strengthened for a day and weakened again in here today. Then the dollar index also weakened a little in here today, but it's continuing to hold its breakout. When we think about the strength of the dollar, the primary reason it's strong is because the Federal Reserve is promising to remove supply. So if they remove supply, that should support the value. They're raising interest rates, so they're increasing the cost of carry, and it's certainly increasing the cost of shorting it. So that's supporting the value. But the big question then is, how high are interest rates going to go before we have negative growth? Now, there's some speculation that we're moving into what might be a manufacturing recession. And the PMI is down to 55. And every time, this is not the most reliable of recession indicators. But you can't have a recession without it moving below 50. So it's starting to contract. We're not there yet. And high yield spreads, they really broke out this week and did not rally with the stock market in here today. Now, they didn't make a new low either, but they're certainly not rallying. So we're up to 475 basis points. Moves above 500 basis points generally coincide with trouble for the wider stock market. So we've definitely seen stocks coming down to the 1,000-day moving average, and we've seen bounces. But I'm rather leery of thinking it's going to be a big bounce, but rather that we're going to see a period of ranging evolve, because investors are going to have to see evidence that some of the liquidity measures that have pressured valuations start to unwind. And how is that going to be possible in a stagflationary environment? Now, as we think about some of the big sell-offs, we've seen really significant moves down for the innovation sector. And the ARK Innovation ETF got down to test the lows from March 2020 in here today. So it could easily rebound. We could see it at 60 in the space of a couple of weeks. But then the question of how do these companies survive when we have higher interest rates is going to come back and become front and center. We even saw that Peloton started to rally over the last couple of days. And of course, it's down in excess of 80%. So it's even in a bear market environment, it can still have a bear market rally. Some of these companies will not survive. And we're seeing that private equity companies are continuing to push for exits. So Instacart has filed for IPO in here this week. And their valuation is probably going to be quite a bit lower than investors were initially hoping for. So this is obviously something that's going to be rather difficult. We're going to have to see interest rate policy reversing before some of these speculative companies with difficulty making profits start to recover. Then let's just think about the value sector and the quality sector. The dividend aristocrats came down to test the region of the lower side of the range that's been forming over the last year and began to steady. Now, it's a loss of consistency to range for longer, but at least it hasn't broken downwards. And then we can think about the value sector. So the value sector is certainly starting to look more attractive as well, and it has a very similar chart pattern overall. So value is clearly outperforming growth. Now, growth is probably going to stage a bit of a comeback because it's so oversold, and there's potential for a reversionary rally. But we're definitely seeing that energy prices are still strong, shipping prices are still strong, and bond yields haven't broken downwards. So it's very arguable how far can this rebound go when financial conditions continue to tighten. I think that it's unlikely that we're going to have a really substantial risk-on rebound until the dollar rolls over. And it's very overbought in the short term. But the dollar is rallying, and I think it's the USA and Russia are competing with one another for the strongest currency. And Russia's ruble has been exceptionally firm over the course of the last month as well, whereas just about every other currency in the world is going downwards. As we think about the secular trends, well, I think that we're at a really important juncture. And I think it's exceptionally important to pay attention to the very long-term trends. 10-year Treasury yields are pausing in the region of the upper side of the range that began to form back in 2011. If this long-term downward trend of yields is going to, in fact, change, then the breakout will have to hold. And we will see that the 1,000-day moving average will start to offer support rather than being a point where investors have looked and thought, well, this obviously represents value and this is about as high as rates are going to go. Obviously, we have this environment where there's a lot of uncertainty and inflation is a really significant problem. And we have slowing growth and central banks tightening liquidity. So it's looking increasingly likely that a recession is going to be inevitable. And then, of course, we have these difficulties in the global economy. The sanctions that are being levied on Russia have created massive dislocations. And that's going to take an awfully long time to work through. And what's happening in China in terms of cutting the economy off and cutting the population off from the global economy, well, that also is going to have a really negative effect. So it's going to represent a growth problem for Europe. Now, we've also seen these big declines in Europe. And they're talking about raising rates, but they're not yet doing anything about it. And the Eurostox index bounced from the upper side of the underlying range in here today and is firming from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. The FTSE 250 has also rebounded, so that is potentially now a higher reaction low, and we're starting to see some additional evidence here that demand is beginning to return to dominance, and putting in a higher reaction low is the beginning of that kind of phase. When we think about Europe, it falls more into the value bracket than Wall Street does, because the FANG companies are infecting everything. When we think about consumer discretionary, well, it's easy to think about consumer companies and think, well, they should be doing well. But the problem for the sector is that Amazon is part of this ETF. And so is Tesla. And together, they represent 37% of the index. So when you buy consumer discretionary, well, it's hard to argue that you're buying what McDonald's. And Nike would be another company that people would associate with this sector, but it's also pulled back in a violent manner. Then Disney would also be a consumer discretionary company, and it has been really heavily sold off. Netflix is also in consumer discretionary, and it is only very tentatively beginning to find support. So when we think about these types of sectors, then it's very clear that a lot of technology has filtered its way into what were once considered to be rather staid. Then if we think about consumer staples, well, then we have less impact from technology, and it's much more of a dividend aristocrat type of company, a list of companies. So that has then held up in a much more robust fashion. Now, when we think about the biotech sector, it has some of the greatest promise of any sector because of technological innovation. The volume of data that's outstanding within healthcare dwarfs any other sector. So then the potential for rapid innovation is really quite attractive. But it also did exceptionally well because of the vaccines that were created in 2021. They took over the index. And as the urgency of the pandemic has ebbed, then the sector has pulled back in a violent manner. And it's really just beginning to find support now. But it's below the trend, both the trend mean of the 200 and the 1,000-day moving averages. There's obviously clear scope for a reversionary rally, but it has a lot of work to do to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And of course, biotech is also the seedbed for innovation in the healthcare sector. And they tend to get bought out by the bigger pharmaceutical companies. So the healthcare sector looks identical to the dividend aristocrats. We've definitely seen a bifurcation in this market. It is clearly favoring anything that's got reliable cash flows. So the kinds of companies that are surprising on the upside in this earnings season are being richly rewarded. And those that miss, and particularly those that don't have profits to back up those misses, well, those companies are being annihilated. I find it rather interesting that even companies that have got really impressive prospects, like Lithium Americas, they own the Thacker Pass lithium deposit in Nevada. They drilled their first initial holes back in 2008. And 14 years later, they're just about finished building the mine. They should be finished building it at some point in the next quarter. And they anticipate starting production in January. So they don't have any profits today. But they have a cost of production somewhere around $3,500. And lithium is trading at $65,000. So they're going to be producing somewhere in the order of about 30,000 tons a year. And when you start multiplying that up, it's going to be a really significant innovation in terms of natural resource in supply in a domestic US situation. There's even talk that the US government is going to pay for the construction of the mine in order to ensure that the supply that comes out of it will stay within the USA. So this is also representative of resource nationalism and also representative of this increasing focus on global supply chains and ensuring that key resources are made available to the economy quickly and easily. And yet the share is down about 50% from the peak posted in February. And this is just another example of how companies that don't have profits but will have profits have been lumped in with those that don't have profits and probably never will. Then I thought another interesting one was Unity Software. The company peaked in November at 200, and it got down as low as the $30 area right after they disappointed on earnings. So Unity Software provides the graphics engine for just about every computer game. And they have an ads, or I guess they have an AI or a data gathering engine within the graphics engine that helps to supply ads to game users. Because 97% of gamers play free games, and in return, they watch ads. So the average gamer watches about 4 minutes of ads every hour. It's one of the few places where people are still willing to sit through ads. And obviously, that's a beneficial part of their business. And they had a negative quarter because they messed up how they were collecting data. And they've been concentrating so much on growth that they don't have profits. But they have sales in the order of $1 billion a quarter, or $1 billion a year, I should say. So this is a company that could be profitable in future, but yet it is down exceptionally heavy. So there's certainly an air of some of the companies that the baby's been thrown out with the bathwater, that we've had a really exceptionally aggressive sell-off where everything has been sold down. So there's definitely the argument that this is a point where some of the better companies with better prospects will start to attract interest. But the wider market is unlikely to fire on an aggressive, strong manner until we start to see some of these threats from aggressive interest rate hikes being withdrawn. If we're thinking about where some of the risks reside, the intensely stringent controls that are being imposed on Chinese citizens are troubling. They're eliciting protests. There's the real possibility that the slowdown in the property market in China could metastasize. So a problem out there in the global economy could have a significant knock-on effect on global growth, and then it would necessitate that we would need to see lower interest rates. So there's certainly the potential that we might see easier monetary conditions in the future, but we're just not there yet. And that suggests that we're still, and I think we should be still, in a cautious environment. Ultimately, we have a huge quantity of debt that's been taken on, and this isn't about to change. And it's going to take time and negative real interest rates to erode that debt over time. That's generally going to be beneficial for gold. And ultimately, the dollar will roll over. And when it rolls over, then it's likely that gold is going to take on clear monetary aspects and rally impressively. We just haven't seen it yet. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to